indignation, usual and accustomed fishing and hunting grounds. The entire upper Columbia Basin, you know, really falls under the purvey, up to the point where the Colvilles assume responsibility beyond this area, so that's their involvement.
So their involvement isn't in the village, their involvement is with remediation and tracking its, the corrective work, because it does feed the source waters of the Columbia River. And they are one of the nations that really have invested in tracking environmental topics, particularly around the state of Washington. Let me back up just a little bit and start with the topic Paul had to see if I can hit some highlights about where we are with our Forest Service permit fee. Quick background, what Holden Village owns, you're sitting in. So it's the buildings, it's the bones of this village is what we own. There's also about 250 acres on the other side of the river that is where the mining activity occurred. There's some patented mines that we own fee to. But this place that we sit and call the village, this little triangle right here, if you can see it, this is the village, here are the mine tailings, this is south, this is north, so it lays part of the land. It sits on Forest Service land, and because we're on Forest Service land, there's a fee attached to the privilege of being having our facilities on their land. Till 2003, the fee that we paid was $693 a year. That's as high as it got. That was probably some negligence on the part of, I shouldn't use that word. It was probably a blessing that they weren't tracking it closely. And it probably should have been higher. Folks recognized for a long time it should have been higher. But it wouldn't have been near as high as a law change that occurred in 2003 for organizational camps on Forest Service lands. In that bill that was passed, due to Holden Village's uniqueness nationwide, our fee went from $693 a year to about $63,000 a year. Just a gasping increase in terms of trying to imagine how we change our budgeting structure to support that fee, because it's a have to do. It's not a like to do. It's a have to do to be here. As an organizational camp, there are some other privileges associated with it in that bill, where we can displace part of that fee by serving certain groups such as youth in environmental education, adults of special needs. Those end up not being a huge part of what Holden's service is, because it's families that come to Holden Village. There's also a much larger privilege if we approach it that we work to do things that the Forest Service would normally be expected to do, and we get credit for that against our fees. And that's the tactic that we have been negotiating with the Forest Service on for a year and a half. And it has been a uphill negotiation, largely because it requires the Forest Service to be very, very interested in having one of the largest volunteer populations that you can find in Washington helping in the forest. And I think it's a bigger task than the local district has imagined taking on. And we've been very anxious to make that happen. So there's an awful lot of work to find a way to dance together so we can receive credit for the work that that we do here. As we have been moving forward with that, the consequence of what we've been paying has been decreasing. The net that we've had to pay, our 2007 fee is about $35,000. Still a very large number, and what you will can hear a lot about is some of the programming we've been undertaking in 2008 to try to even drive that down further and subsequent years, '08, '09, and that's with a trails program. We have a trails coordinator this year who is leading the way to find volunteers to work this entire valley, the Railroad Creek Valley, out of which we will get some credit for that investment as we try to bring those trails to a certain standard. A lot of our effort as Holden Village is to work with the Forest Service to get more credit for that effort, because this may be one of the only places they can attempt to meet their standard, as opposed to other places in the forest where they can't meet the standard. And they get locked up a little bit in the paradigm of what they can do elsewhere as opposed to here, and that plays into the difficulty of them trying to give full recognition for all that we can do. There's a rather unique thing that has been approved by the region. There are 9 regions in the country. We're in region
6.
Is it 6? Okay. That's out of Portland. Forest regions. In that, in future years, if it's something Holden wants to tackle, volunteer groups that can work for, and there's a series of caveats to it, but in essence, volunteer groups that enter the forest and do volunteer work can donate their hours to Holden, and we would get credit for that against our fee. No one's real certain how we make that happen, but it's pretty exciting that that could happen all the way across the country. And it also has our local forest district a bit nervous, because it falls on them to try to figure out how to manage that connection locally, regionally, or across the country. But it's I think, a wonderful recognition that folks are listening to the problem that we have with the this enormous fee that is, again, unique to Holden. We are, our size and the visitation is what creates that level of fee that we have. So, all that said, I think it's the note I would at least stop talking on is that I think it's very positive news that we have a roadmap ahead of us in terms of how we can work this fee down to something we're targeting at around $10,000 is a comfortable level that we can support through the donations and budgeting activity that Holden undertakes. And so those numbers are getting closer together, and it's a matter of us working continually optimistically that we can get there, that I think it will happen. The support that helps make it happen in many ways is you as the community, because it's a bigger environment that influences what goes on here. And it has been, the involvement has all been all the way up to the National Senate level. And one senator in particular has made Holden one of the things on her agenda, Maria Cantwell, in her efforts of working with the Forest Service. Holden Village is in her dialogue with them. It comes up on a periodic basis and regular enough that folks locally are more anxious to find a way to fix this, because it is getting some national attention. So keep your cards and letters going out to your representatives and senators, and know that there's at least one of them that whose name does come up during the conversations with the Forest Service. So, those were a lot of words and a lot of territories. Are anything that is still curious to folks about where we are on that, the tactics we're using?
If we choose to write our senators or representatives, is there a bill number? How do we address that to them?
It's the National Forest Organizational Camp fee of 2003. There is certainly a bill number, and I wish I knew. So I could tell you the title of the bill.
Can it be put in the newsletter?
Yes.
Some information about the right.
Yes, we'll find some, we need to, I need to find better ways to get information out on our website and stuff to keep you current on some of these.
Paul, does Holden have any kind of a contract, a written contract with the Forest Service, or is this all handled kind of ad hoc or a casual basis?
It is not yet. There is a contract. It's a memo of agreement in terms of the activities we're going to undertake. We usually spend at least the first two that we've gone through because of where we need this to go and the amount of effort it takes to get some momentum on the Forest Service part. Usually we haven't signed the 2008 yet. It's still in draft form. We've got everything in place, and we're working as if it exists, but we're waiting for it to come back from the Forest Service.
So then, at the end of the year, I mean, I guess my question is there a level of performance that Holden's required to meet once one of those that's written to that document, or is it instead kind of like a menu that says if you do this, this is how we'll mitigate the fee, and if you do this, this is how we'll mitigate the fee?
There are many line item activities in this agreement that measure very specific, for example, trails.
Yeah, so it's kind of like a do what you can do, and then we'll appraise. I'm just trying
it
to
is, how it's actually it. More than that. It is a commitment on our part that we're going to do what we say is in that agreement.
Okay.
And they'll be anxious for us to do that because they feel the urgency to get other groups involved if we can't do it.
Okay.
Is it basically a fixed fee arrangement, or is it a time and materials? If we have more people out working on trails, do we get more of a mitigation than if we have fewer people?
It's time and materials to a maximum.
To a maximum. Okay. And is it just 1 year at a time, or could
yes,
we?
Just 1 year at a time.
Really, that's hard. Can we do something to get a 5 or 10 year thing?
Well, at this point, I'd rather be 1 year at a time because 5 year would lock us into a place that we're not ready to do.
Yeah.
So it's, I think we need to be working the negotiations we're doing to get it to the right place and then get to a multi-year would truly be marvelous. And I think this first year of trail maintenance is going to be evidence of whether or not they have comfort of a large volunteer body doing that.
How do you think this agreement depends upon who is our president? Is it dependent upon whether Republican is a president or a Democrat or a specific person?
No, it depends more on who the district ranger is. The district ranger has all the privilege he needs to make this go away, but is also rather autonomous. The Forest Service is so big that it's
right.
It's given a lot of privilege in terms of latitude of decision.
But he is appointed by the head of the Forest Service, is appointed by the president.
No, the district ranger is appointed by the forest supervisor, who's appointed by the region forester, who's appointed by the chief forester, who's appointed by the secretary of deputy secretary of agriculture, who's appointed by the
president.
By the Secretary of Agriculture, is appointed by the President. Yeah. Is there 6 degrees of separation?
Is that another group that should be written to besides the senators and representatives? People in the Forest Service? Will that just aggravate them?
Well, at this point, letters to the Forest Service, any aggravation is probably helpful. And I say that not in the sense of harassment, because it'll just make Holden Village this dreadful place to even want to sort of dive into. But I think as long as it's kept on the front burner, then it's our job to take that front burner attention and see how we can work it into some positive action.
Is there some way in the newsletter, whatever you're going to publish in, just to kind of give suggestions of what would be good to highlight with those different people?
Yes, that's a great idea. And where my hesitancy comes is the Forest Service reads everything we publish, so I often run through my head in terms of how to portray that without losing my credibility that has been developed.
Have someone else write.
So anyway, it's a great idea, and it's a matter of figuring out how to do that.
I want to say that Paul and Chuck worked things out very well with the Forest Service last fall, and with the Forest District Ranger last fall, and this spring in April, it was like he had amnesia. He forgot everything. And the negotiations had to start all over again, and it was Paul and Chuck holding the Rangers sort of memory to the fire. And if that has to keep on continuing, we just rely upon our negotiators' skills. There's Senator Cantwell, with whom Paul has developed a really good relationship with over the years prior to Holden Village even. And that's one of the reasons why we're able to have ready access to her office. But she doesn't have a lot of power dealing with a district ranger except writing letters the same way as we do, and making phone calls. And it's such a tenuous relationship because the district ranger has a lot of power over Holden Village and can make, we've had district rangers in the past who have made Holden life very difficult, and we had to use all of the political power we had in the 60s, which was actually quite good because of just the relationships that had been built up then. But it gets very dicey, so we're just glad Paul and Chuck are good diplomats. They don't push things too hard, but they keep pushing.
Actually,
I don't want to be heard that today.
Is that District Chelan?
Yes.
District Ranger?
And my biggest fear of being so candid with you is that folks leave here thinking that we have someone that we should mount some kind of campaign against.
Yes, I know.
With the district ranger. I like the guy a lot. He's...
Who is that?
It's Bob Sheehan.
Maybe we should write him and tell him how grateful we are to him. Thanks a lot for helping us. What a great guy you are.
Well, I actually would go a long way for him, but... He's also someone who has a huge responsibility to get his arms around it. He is someone who very much needs to be in control, and Holden is one of those places that's so organic, it just drives folks crazy trying to figure out what's really going on here, particularly because they can't be up here like they want to be or need to be. It is an incredibly active place, and it's a place that is on what he views as his land to manage. So there lies this dance that we're developing in terms of how he can trust that what we have done for 47 years and plan to do for the next 200 years at least can be to their advantage, that we are a gem in the forest of this nation. And look at.
Does the fee money go into his budget, or does it just disappear?
Great question. There's one of the anxiousness of Bob is to find a solution. He's getting a lot of pressure to make this go away, and it makes his life very difficult to have to deal with it so much. There are two things that we can be classified up here by the federal guidelines. One of them is an organizational camp, which is what we are. The other is a resort. They're both sort of names on paper as to what they're really all about. But the fees calculated very differently in terms of the two approaches. The other fee that they've offered is to let us be classified on paper as a resort. It has the advantage that it has a minimum fee we pay that's less than we're currently paying. The minimum fee is just about $25,000 a year. But there isn't any way for us to move that lower, that it's based, I go through the accounting on it, but it's a fairly complex series of accounting things that we have to do to be a resort. If we're a resort, all of the money goes to Washington, D.C. If we're an organizational camp, all the money goes to the district. So there's an advantage to the district for us to be an organizational camp. Bob isn't, at this point, we're fairly small in his budget, but he portrays it doesn't matter to him which way it goes. But the money does stay local when we are an organizational camp.
What is the legal basis for this?
Federal law.
There's been a federal law. Is it a new law, or is it just something that they didn't?
Well, organizational camp legislation, I don't know how long that goes back, a long way. In 2003, it was amended. And so there's the 2003 organizational camp fee, that bill that was went through Congress that drives what I've just described. So stay tuned, be positive, pray for how we get through this, and it will keep the momentum going. While it isn't declining at sort of what I had optimistically hoped we could land at, I do feel good that it is moving in the right direction. It has actually challenged us to think of ways to work the mission of the village in some pretty remarkable ways. And this Trails program is one element of that that has so many elements of being Holden, giving folks a wilderness experience, giving youth and adults and families a chance to be in the woods and help take care of this valley that his buildings exist in. So, I don't think it would have launched so quickly if we weren't trying to solve this problem. So, I feel real positive that there are good things that come out of all of this tension. So, with that, you want to talk about something else? How about this box of stuff?
Can I ask a
question? Yes.
Are there other organizational groups across the country that have been hit hard also, do you know?
When we first started into this, the answer that you heard was no. It appears, somewhat because of Cantwell's office asking the question over and over again of the district and the region, that there may be a few others that have significant increases. It's not clear, I don't know the details. It doesn't sound like they're as big as Holden's. But up to this point, the traditional organizational camp has been Boy Scout camps and small church camps, where they have much smaller participation. So in many of those, if not most, the recrafted bill was written so their fees would go down. Because so many of them are focused on a very specific sector of the population. And there are these very specific sectors that were identified in the bill. So. It's hard to say so in terms of the bill, I think it was actually crafted to try to help people, and Holden is unique in many ways.
That makes me wonder, maybe, is there something that could be suggested as the be friendlier to Holden?
Yes. I mean, it could be as simple as Holden is exempt. But it's...
that's usually kind of difficult. So I was thinking of something a little more generic.
I think the question is, Holden's not being punished. They're just trying to figure out a way that's proportional in the footprint and the usage that's equal to all.
Holden fell into a big crack when this thing was recrafted. And because of how it was written and how you calculate the fee,
due to footprint usage and
well, the fee, the organizational camp fee is based on, there's a land value fee that's attached, and Chelan County land value just doubled in this last assessor's work.
Even when they're sitting next to a tailing pond?
Yes, the answer to that is yes. So there's a land-based fee, and then there is a fee that is 5% of gross revenues. So as Holden's use grows, even though the fees we charge for people to be here are only about 60% of the actual cost, the more folks that are that keep coming back, the fee goes up. So it's an interesting thing that we have success, just increases the fee. So in terms of a bill change, the answer is yes. It is probably the most difficult of all the routes to follow, because someone has to sponsor that. The Forest Service cannot do that, even if they wanted to. They're very clear that it's not their role, it's not appropriate for them to do it. So it takes a series of legislators to get together and have some kind of broader network of Holdens out there that have this problem. So it's not just one congressperson that is trying to craft a bill and then write it, have a lot of folks sign on to it, get it through both houses. So that it's a pretty monumental thing to imagine this little dot doing. It might be the kind of thing that Holden can do, but it will take years to sort of transpire. There's another route that may be a little easier but follows the same course, but it can be more specific, and that's to try to get the land under the village, so it's not Forest Service land, but it's owned by the nonprofit of Holden Village. There have been times where we have had conversations of looking to swap this 20 acres for, you know, maybe the whole 250 acres up here. And it hasn't been received in a real positive light because of the next thing we want to talk about, and that's remediation. Because much of this land has been tainted with the tailings and the windblown tailings of, and there's some specific guidelines on Forest Service or the U.S. government taking ownership of land that's otherwise tainted. So, might be a great segue to talk a little bit about the things that Wayne has been connected with probably for more years than I have, and how we're doing on remediation. I think the thing I'd like to start with on remediation, how many folks have heard about it or heard what we're doing, something about what we're doing? How many of you are holding your breath? We've had a few casualties of people holding their breath, so I would ask you to breathe. The notion that something needs to happen here goes back as long as Holden's has been a not-for-profit. And it wasn't until the 80s that some more definitive action was taken to come and seal the tailings, and Holden was part of that process back in the 80s. And at that point, they thought they were done. But there was more research that found there were some the chain of custody of that ownership. There was a discovery that they could find it and link it to subsequent mining companies that currently exist. And we went through sort of the chain of ownership from the Helm mining company to its current company, which I understand, I think I just heard, sold to another company. The way that the mine cleanup laws are written, as well as the Clean Water Act, is that anyone who has any association with the problem has liability to help clean it up. And of course, the deepest pockets in all of that are the mining companies that currently have this, or part of the chain of custody. And to the To their credit, and I'm sure there's a lot of important strategy on their part when they did it, they stepped forward and said they would take the lead in this cleanup, which was a really important step in terms of something happening on that whole village. Or in his mind. They stepped forward in the 90s, early 90s, mid-90s. And that, I think, started the sense that something would happen fairly quickly because someone had stepped forward to say they would pay for it. It started a process of looking at what it takes to clean this area up. And those of you that were here a few days ago, you would have been here while some engineers from URS are here trying to do some more investigation. Some contractors are here drilling wells, continuing that investigation. Those folks have been here in and out of this village since about 96, looking at these tailings, trying to come up with an answer. Over that period of time, over the last 12 years, there have been a lot of answers crafted, and those have generated a lot of debate between the regulatory agencies and the folks that have said they would step forward and pay for it. Excuse me. That's what this box is. And as I look through there, what Paul has not brought down, thank goodness, or his back may have given away, is there are at least 2-3 inch binders that are even somewhat more recent of the current last couple of years that have been crafted approaches to solve this problem. Those crafted approaches have come from two different places. One is the agencies. When they got to the point where they were not happy with what Intaco was proposing, they in essence disappeared for 2 years and crafted what they think the answer was. And because of the agencies, it's not that they have to think that's what the answer is, that is what the answer is. That really got the attention of the mining company, because what the agencies came up with was an answer that cost tens of millions of dollars more than what the mining company thought it was going to cost to clean this up. It raised for the mining company a lot of issues that they stepped forward to pay attention to, because it meant we can either try to find a solution or we can go to court and let a judge decide what the answer is. And in some ways, the court may not even decide. There is some declarative privilege on the part of the agencies, and the agencies are Forest Service, EPA, and Washington Department of Ecology. And they have some privilege to declare what it's going to take to clean this up and can proceed. And then it's a matter of arguing over dollars and who's going to pay for it. I suppose a little bit of leverage the mining company had is that this is a Superfund eligible site, but there's no money in the Superfund. So it really does come down to having someone to pay for it, whether it's the mining company or the agencies move through some kind of appropriations bill to generate $70 to $120 million to work the cleanup plan. There's some things up here that there aren't nearly enough to go around for those that are really curious, and we can share what they look like. If I could,
Well, perhaps one thing that might help you understand the dilemma that we've been faced with. I got very actively involved after my project to rebuild the diversion for our hydro and potable water system, and was asked to start participating in the negotiation process, or in the interaction process between
the agencies and the mine company, and Holden was there basically as a listener and not very actively involved at the direction of the folks that were directors of the village at that point in time and the board. What happens is with the tailings and with the water that comes out of the mine, as you walk up the road roadway up to level 3, you'll see a stream of water in a channel alongside the roadway. That's water that's coming out of what is Portal 3. And the mine itself filled entirely with water. And so the minerals that are in the mountain, that what little bit of minerals are left there, go into solution, and they come out of the mine in that stream of water that comes down and enters Railroad Creek. Then you also have a series of groundwater sources that are flowing through the tailings and into the creek itself. And so this develops a level of people refer to them as heavy metals. It's metal constituents of copper, zinc, cadmium, and iron are the primary chemicals of concern. And if people were concerned that we were at threat of our own public health, the level of these metals that are getting into Railroad Creek are below drinking water level standards. The water is safe to drink. Those metals are at such low level. So why is there a problem? Well, the problem, as defined by the agencies and by law, is that as those metals come into the creek, into Railroad Creek, they interfere with the normal aquatic life in the creek. And the primary aquatic life that they are impacting is not the fish themselves, but the insects that live in the water that are food for the fish. And there's a couple of things that are happening. That the chemicals from the mine are basically copper, cadmium, and zinc. And they have a method of a very slight impact on insect life. The biggest impact is the one that you see as very prevalent in the creek itself, where it starts to turn orange. And if you walk into the creek in that area, you will find that rather than seeing clean rocks with moss and algae on them, you see rocks that are covered with powder, a red rusty powder. That's iron. And that's iron that's coming out of the tailings as the groundwater moves down through there. With that powdery flock on the rocks, the moss and algae can't grow, there's no food for the insects. So you end up with an area of the creek starting at the tailings and on downstream for about 3 or 4 miles where the amount of food that's available in the creek then reduces the population of fish in the creek. It doesn't kill the fish. The fish are still there, they're still present, and there's nothing wrong with them. They're perfectly healthy fish, but they're totally dependent upon essentially the drift insects that come down the creek from up above and provide a source of food for them in that lower reach of the creek. Further evidence on my part that in terms of the limited and the very minimal amount of environmental impact to fish health is that as you go on downstream further, we have an active spawning population of kokanee salmon. This is a landlocked sockeye salmon from Lake Chelan that comes in and spawns in the lower reaches of Railroad Creek. So if there was a real serious problem with cadmium, zinc, and copper, it would inhibit that population of kokanee from having an active spawning population in the creek. So we're faced with this situation where the agencies have said, well, you have this problem, you have to eliminate all of these chemicals. That's all well and good, but you have to get to the water to do that first. It's real easy to capture the water out of the mine portal. However, the water that's coming down through the tailings and entering into Railroad Creek is quite a different situation because it's not very easy to get to. So the early process of this started out with what is called a draft environmental impact statement. The mine company contracted with URS, the engineering firm that you've seen here presently, to prepare that draft environmental impact statement that was finished, I believe, in 97 or 98.
And there are several volumes of documents in the library that you're welcome to go in and read if you want. I think the shelf is about this wide with those documents, where they have documented all of the evidence concerning the influence of this water that comes down to the creek. There were 9 alternatives prepared in that draft environmental impact statement. Since that process was sort of put on hold by the agencies, they literally stopped talking to anybody about it because they felt that there was a better way. And they hired their own consulting firm to come up with a brand new plan. And so now instead of 9 alternatives, there are 13 alternatives, including the very last proposal that has come to the agencies from the mine company. And alternative 13 is one that I found very exciting, and that it took a very radical change in approach in terms of how they were going to capture this water coming through the tailings. And one that for the village was also very, very interesting in that the engineering firm that the agencies hired came up with a plan that would probably impact the village very significantly over a period of 4 or 5 years, in that there would be major construction going on in the village and around the mine tailings for that 4 or 5 year period. And with alternative 13 that's been prepared by the mine company and URS, we're looking at one very significant summer of extreme construction activity here, and probably part of a second summer, and it might be the summer before the big summer or the summer after the big summer. But it a huge difference in terms of the impact to the village operation from the construction work that will have to be done here. What's happened in the most recent past that is encouraging is that the agencies have agreed to allow URS to go ahead with the testing that has to be done to prove that the proposal 13 that they are offering will indeed meet the requirements that the agencies want. And so that's the challenge that's before URS, and it's one that is very significant in that the agencies gave them a very short time frame to get that done, rather than a typical period of about 12 to 16 months to gather the data and put together a plan. The window that they're looking at is they have to have at least a preliminary plan ready for the agencies this fall. So they are scrambling, and that's why you've seen them here on site and why they've been so aggressive gathering data so that they can make sure that this option 13 really does meet the needs for what the agencies are asking.
I share with you the activities that are undertaken have been made a priority. We have made it a priority for them to be able to tackle those. I want to emphasize what Wayne said about the difference between the agency's plan and the mining company's plan. Not only do they physically look different, and we'll describe a little bit of the physical difference, because it is pretty exciting could come of it. The amount of time it will take to implement those plans is fairly dramatic to Holden Village and the mission that we work here at this place in River Creek Valley. The agency's plan requires massive grading of the tailings and the building of some concrete underground walls to cut off groundwater that go down as deep as 100 feet. Those activities in a very short construction window, we have about a little over 100 days that are generally constructible up here because the snow finally melts and the snow finally starts. And when you have a very big operation, you have to open it up, work, and then button it up before winter strikes, and that just stretches things out. That the agency plan, which will do what it needs to do to clean up, reach the environmental levels that need to the water, take 3 to 5 years to do of heavy construction. The Intalco plan, which is largely to move the river away from the pollution source, is, it goes back to a somewhat similar plan when Wayne talked about the original 9 plans. Number 5, which was favored by the Forest Service, but it wasn't liked by the other agencies, did look at moving the river toward the village, away from the tailings piles, and using the old riverbed as the to capture what it's been doing for years, and that's the pollutant, the iron coming out of these tailings here. And Intalco relooked at that, found a way that they think they can do it. And my guess is they're probably a bit optimistic of being able to do it in a year, year and a half. But as we meet with them, we keep their feet to the fire of saying, wow, this is really a year. We're on board with that. But from a village, I think we need to acknowledge that it's likely at least 2 construction seasons that we are going to be heavily impacted by construction. That's a very different approach to sort of plan ahead for what this place can be and build the anticipation of what it is like when it emerges from those years of environmental cleanup, which is absolutely necessary.
Alternative 5 was one that brought the creek in close, very close to the village up in the upper reaches and close to Narnia, the school area. And the alternative 13, the movement of the creek, will be more aggressive beyond the school. It will come in as you get beyond the area where the school is where the impact would begin to be felt. And alternative 5, I think, was not really a favorite of several of the folks that were here on a regular basis in the village as well. They felt it came in too close to the school area and was one that didn't gain a lot of support from the village. But what they are proposing now is to relocate the creek in a manner that will bring it in very close to the road as you go on down from the village and down towards 10 Mile Creek. So there will be, and I agree with Paul, there is, and where they find bedrock is going to have a big impact on the time it's going to take to do that stream relocation. But to be able to capture the water coming through the tailings in the old channel and take it to a treatment area is one that makes a lot of sense, and it minimizes the amount of construction on this side of the creek. It also gives the stream a fish-friendly environment, essentially immediately, with not having to wait for cleanup and wait for years of wall construction. But within a very brief period of time, we have a new stream channel that supports fish and a healthy population of fish.
So how does Holden fit into this picture of what's going on? We're this dot on a map that is amidst international mining companies and 3 powerhouse agencies that are regulating the cleanup. We're talking cleanup dollars of $70 to $100 million, which certainly these buildings aren't worth that much. And the role Holden plays is that through the process of environmental cleanup, the local community is a consideration in terms of what the community's opinion of the fixes, the cleanup plan. And that is a voice that has to be considered as they evaluate the alternatives. Our voice has been really loud that there are some constraints that we need to be satisfied, and that is shorter than longer construction periods, because it's something that we've heard from a lot of folks imagining how Holden can turn perhaps a couple heavy construction years into opportunity as opposed to feeling victim to it. But if it stretches to 5 years, it's a lot harder to imagine how to sustain that kind of sense that it's opportunity and not losing a generation of visitors to Bill, the folks who are going to take their turn to help run this place sometime in the future. The other is the environmental cleanup. It is a significant issue for the village that the cleanup occur, because we live next to it. We visit next to it. We have a strong interest in the ecology and the environment of this valley, and I think that too is a voice they heard on our part. And the third is recognizing Holden's mission, and how do we continue to work the mission as any of these things have functioned. The reason that the mining company is given the opportunity to have this summer to be able to validate their plan came down to Holden Village expressing strong and deep concern for the for not giving that full consideration as an alternative. And there's the feedback from folks who are high-ranking officials that shall not be named have expressed clearly that it was Holden's voice that allowed this other approach to occur. So I share that with you in terms of the significance of your voice as a community and staying in touch and being involved and watching for what occurs. If I showed you a map of how this process proceeds, there's a few more steps involved, including community participation, where the plan, when it's finally announced, is taken to public hearing. And they have to listen to the voice of all that come and have an opinion about the plan and its effects and whether people support it or object to it. So it really was 11:59 when there was a shift in the road earlier this year that allowed this to occur.
11:59, yeah.
We were quiet as a village, and the posture was we didn't have any authority or any reason to be voicing any concerns during the process of the EIS and going through this. But we were blessed with the services of an attorney who has been providing us with a great deal of direction and support, because he is specializing in this kind of activity, and this service is being given to Holden as a pro bono gift to the village. And Tom Newland is the attorney. He's a member of my church on Bainbridge Island. And Tom finally got to the point where he said, "You guys got to speak up." He said, "We've been sitting here dragging our feet, and it isn't going to do any good. So it's time to say something." And wonderful comments from the board and from the directors. And lo and behold, something did happen. So it was a blessing to see this change in attitude, and things began to happen.
Let me tell you where we are and where we're going. We are. Don't hold your breath. No one hold your breath. But as we follow through the summer, there's a lot of validation going on. Physical validation of the mining company's plan as they drill holes, track groundwater, move rock. In essence, trying to figure out how the pollutant train under the surface moves, and whether or not they can create an isolated new stream corridor, not isolated, something that functions so that we can have a clean stream corridor and for it to have some hydraulic capacity so that it not only moves major storms through, it isn't going to wander, and that it has some underground pressure that holds the pollutants where they want it to be and they can then treat it. It has to validate. There's a prediction of this taking 200 years for this site to clean up. So there is a lot of effort made in some durability of whatever the solution is. We are, hold on just a second. If we make the assumption that everyone is going to be in agreement at the end of this calendar year, all the agencies, the mining company, and the community, it is about the earliest major construction could occur is 2011. That isn't very far away, but it's still years away. And that time period between now and 2011 is really an important time to figure out a lot of things about how Holden enters, the remediation time, what we do during that time, and how we emerge ready for the next 50 years as we have been here for the first 50 years. So those are some of the timelines of what's coming. So, should we do questions?
Sure.
And yours, you had your arm up so much.
No, I have a question about the water that is leaching the metals out of the tailings. Is it coming from rainwater or is it coming from seepage through the side of the mountain? Where does it come from?
All of the above. There's water that is there, groundwater that's there from snow melt.
Yeah.
So as the snow melts, it percolates into the soil. So and rainwater as well. You have aquifers that are perched back here, and this is one of the things that the URS folks are doing now, is to define where those aquifers, where those sources of groundwater are, where they're coming from.
And they get into the tailings.
They come through the tailings. So we have that, and most of the contamination that's coming from the tailings, about, I would say, close to 80% or 90% of that is iron. The copper, cadmium, and zinc are coming from the mine itself. There's a very small amount of additional copper, cadmium, and zinc that get into the creek from the tailings themselves. So it's trying to stop this iron flock that's forming in the creek by this groundwater moving through the tailings.
It seems to me like the problem is somewhat similar to what the Atomic Energy Commission has, where they try to contain radioactive material from coming out of something. And so I think they tend to encapsulate it with something. Why can't the tailings be encapsulated with something impermeable? I don't know that concrete is the best thing. There might be NASA space age plastics that are better, but just keeping it so rainwater can't get into it.
Well, you still have groundwater coming from above.
Well, you will, but
that comes down through there. And this was the alternative that the agencies just came up with, where they wanted to put in these barrier walls to stop that groundwater from getting to the tailings.
But does that groundwater have a lot of minerals in it?
It does have some minerals in it. It has some minerals as well, because the whole area here is...
Because if you cut down the effluent by a factor of 100, the problem kind of goes away. Then maybe you have some fish feeders up feeding fish into the creek.
Part of what happens as they look through different options, and that's why there's so many, is that some of it plays into a lot of it plays into constructability. We're remote, and the... balancing trying to encapsulate for eternity or allow for some natural attenuation. And the natural attenuation, they're looking at being between 100 and 200 years. So it's, there's a lot of design and policy debate that goes on as to what really creates that, that protection. Plus, the real measurement is water quality. And that's the... challenge, so that we meet.
But it sounds like the water quality is fine. It's below.
No, it's not.
It's below you can drink the water.
It's below the drinking level standard, but it's not below the requirements for fish health.
Well, it will feed the fish. You buy an awful lot of fish food for $1 million.
Well, there's a couple things going on too, because this project started out following a solid track of being part of the federal, following federal rules. At the point, and through those federal rules, there was a technique, a standard for measuring what water quality was, and there were some solutions that came out of it. State of Washington, once it became part of this agency review, has a different set of rules in terms of how you measure whether you've contained or eliminated the pollutant train. And their measurement is not to necessarily just monitor the river to see if the river meets standard, but it concludes that everything that enters the river has to meet standard. And that created sort of a whole new paradigm in what it took to clean this up, because dilution was no longer a solution to this cleanup. It really required that everything be captured and brought to a standard before it was released. Go ahead.
By moving the creek bed, that doesn't completely solve the problem, does it?
solves a lot of very big problems. One, the stream bed can be built in about one season, and we'll have an immediate ecosystem in place. The reason it's such a attractive solution is that it hopefully requires a dramatic drop in the amount of grading that has to occur on the tailings, so that the tailings don't have to be moved. Originally, part of the challenge for the agency so they could build this barrier wall that's right next to the existing creek is they had to move the tailings back. Once you touch the tailings, you have to lay them back to a very flat grade. And there were tens of thousands of yards of tailings that had to be moved. The tailings themselves have a variable crust that has formed over time to give them some strength. And as they break that, it's mush. So the challenge is trying to predict how long it'll take to sort of grade out that mush, pile it someplace else, protect it, and reestablish some kind of barrier coating that goes on top. That takes an immense amount of time. So moving the creek means that hopefully they found ways to validate the stability of those embankments out there so that they don't have to grade them to half.
The old stream bed is going to intercept the groundwater flow, and so you're going to be capturing that, and it's going to be taken to a treatment location.
So
that water that's coming through the tailings and being captured in the old stream bed is going to go to a treatment facility. In addition, there will be a treatment facility for the water coming out of the mine. So you'll have two different locations where you're treating two different sources of material. And so that way we do capture all of that. I think we had one.
Yes, I have sort of a small potatoes question, and that would be, as part of the remediation, what possibility is there that the village would get funding for some of our structural
concerns here?
Because, you know, I've been coming here for years, and it seems like paint might be the only thing that's holding everything together.
And we did a good job of
paint. It's good paint.
That's why we like latex.
Because it seems like the heavy construction might do damage to the village in a way, and
there's a lot of thinking in terms of what to do during those construction periods. And one possibility is that Holden be the place that houses the miner, or houses the construction company. It's laced with all sorts of things that we're not used to, because the people here working on the mine are not here for the mission of the village. And there's this interface that there's a lot of mystery about exactly what will happen with that interface. But assume we sort of figure all that out, and we do house them here. We are at a point where we've had some viability discussions with the mining company about whether we could exchange room and board for capital improvements. And there's real positive note on their part. There's a lot of questions on their part, but it seems to be a very valid exchange in this grand world. So we've actually created a series of priorities of things that need to be done so that we can be prepared for the next 50 years. And they include things like more hydropower and our electric distribution system, our water system, firefighting, and raw water systems, and perhaps some electric vehicles that we're looking at that could save us fuel, but even construction like buildings. So there's a whole list of things, and it really comes down to dollars and cents about what it would cost them to otherwise have an encampment as opposed to us providing those services. So it's a great question.
Right.
So two treatment facilities are added. I'm assuming it's going to take some people to run those facilities. Does that mean that there will be, sometime in the future, three communities in Railroad Creek Valley, or one community, namely Holden Village, with three campuses?
Well, the hope is that Holden Village, we're in the business of treating water. We're in the business, even though we do it with volunteers, it's something we have to do, we're mandated to do, and of maintenance and operation. And the hope is that Holden Village is the operator, or provides operational services to those long-term service needs, whether it's power, whether it's effluent treatment from the wells, from the mining operation. The treatment plants are fairly low maintenance facilities. They use a lot of gravity. There's some mixing of some chemistry into them so that they capture and create a solid material flock that falls out and that has to be disposed of. But it's fairly low intensity work. And it may be one person is all that's necessary to sort of sustain the background operations for the cleanup.
Mark?
I was wondering about the, have mentioned that it's affecting our aquatic life. Is it only affecting our railroad creek downward, or is it affecting any other waterways?
It's about 4 to 5 miles of Railroad Creek are the areas of impact. There is some small residual that does continue on down towards Lake Chelan, but it precipitates out by the time Railroad Creek water reaches Lake Chelan, the level of contamination is well below the standards that are required by the agencies.
I'm gonna let everyone know that it's after 9:30. And we'd probably like to let folks go because there's a lot of tired folks in the audience.